The following programming is sponsored by MBC Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Stand by. Fire!
For another Project Chaos radio show, number 12, live from Philadelphia. We're here today to talk a little bit about Vietnam. You know, there's only about 800,000 Vietnam vets remaining alive with us today. And I understand and respect that Vietnam means many different things to many different people. And it makes it hard to talk about, and for good reason. And why is that? Well, there was a lot of suffering. The question is, why was there suffering? That was really just the beginning, the suffering that occurred in Vietnam. Our own country turned their backs on our own young veterans when they came home. No, they didn't turn their backs. I said that wrong. They spit in their faces, literally. Vietnam veterans going a million miles away to fight a war, some of them not voluntarily, many of them, they come home, the people here spit in their faces. And as much as you'd like to think that times have changed, they have not completely changed. That's just one of the reasons why I think it's important that we have this discussion. Much of what came out of Vietnam affected my own experience in the Marine Corps many years after that. What do I mean by that? Well, there were Marines that I served with who had been in Vietnam, like our first sergeant, my first sergeant, and our section chief, both were old Vietnam veterans, and they took their legacy very seriously, and we benefited from that. Even through everything that they had seen and done, they saw that the Marine Corps and the Marines were good and that the legacy had to live on. They saw that the young Marines deserved something better, and they made sure that it happened. And because of that, we can be very grateful for their work. But the other reason I think it's so important that we have this discussion, painful as it can be, for the 800,000 remaining Vietnam veterans alive with us today, it's important that we have these conversations because we see history repeating itself. And if we don't uncover the truth, who will? Welcome to Project Chaos, the radio show that brings you the mindset and perspective of our nation's warriors. I'm your host, Chris Kunkel, United States Marine Corps combat veteran and author of my newest book, Victory Over Chaos, which tells the true story behind the United States Marines' battle for Kafchi. I don't care about being the biggest or the highest paid. Ever since I was 17 years old, took my oath to enlist, I only ever strive to be the best I can. If you like what you hear, please be sure to visit projectchaos.org. You know, it's a real honor for me to be here speaking about these things, Vietnam especially. A lot of guys that were hurt bad in many ways, physically, emotionally, mentally. A lot of mistakes were made and no real accountability for that. And a real bad situation, much of what could have been avoided. But considering all that, what was it like in Vietnam? In a few minutes, I'm going to introduce you to an Army Vietnam veteran. His name is John Podlasky. Not only a Vietnam veteran, he's also an author. I read his book, Cherries, and I have to tell you, it's incredible work. He's also written several other books and done huge volumes of work on the subject of Vietnam and the experience there. We're going to hear from him firsthand. But first, I want to share a little story that I found that struck with me. This story came not from Leatherneck magazine. My brother, what magazine did this come from? It wasn't the Oh, it was the Marine Corps Gazette, I guess.
The Gazette, correct.
The Gazette, one of the two. All right. Anyway, the story was written by Colonel Joseph Long, and he enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1966. He was a corporal originally with 2-9. So you got a colonel, retired colonel, who served as originally enlisted. And he was with 2-9. After being honorably discharged, he went on to receive his bachelor's degree. Then in 1974, went back to the Marine Corps, served as an officer. Mm-hmm. Can't talk today. Officer for 37 years. 37 years. Now retired Colonel Joseph Long. Well, he shared this story about his good friend, George Pace. And it's the story of George Pace that I want to tell you about today. Listen to me carefully. Maybe if you're a veteran, you might know a similar story. I think there had to be one of these guys in every unit. George Pace was a thin, wiry guy, not best suited to be the radio man for the unit that he was part of, the job that he was supposed to be doing. Why is that? Well, these radios can get heavy. But he was such a great guy that he did so much for others in the unit that he was very popular as a result. He was always giving back, giving, doing more for others than he did for himself. Finally, George Pace was killed when a piece of shrapnel from a lone artillery round struck a chapel where he was literally kneeling at the altar and praying. That's where he died, July 4th, 1967. And it was one of those losses that really shook the unit. And I'll say this, you hear oftentimes that these stories will occur where there's somebody who's very popular in the unit, very well liked, and then something happens where they get jammed up and it just, it causes a ripple through the unit. And you'll hear that carried out in different ways. Well, in this case, the colonel chose to honor George Pace by sharing this story about Christmas in Vietnam, 1966. I know a little bit about what it's like to be deployed on Christmas. I spent a Christmas deployed. And it's an interesting experience. Well, back in 1966, the colonel was there with George Pace. The unit had been living in muddy, rain-soaked conditions for a few months. And let me just describe to you a little bit what this is like from my own perspective. Maybe our brother John Podlosky will share a little bit more. But when I say muddy, rain-soaked conditions, this isn't a situation where you get wet and you start to get cold. You can just hop inside for a little bit, pop off your clothes and throw them in the dryer and head back out. You're stuck out there. I spent a little time up at Jungle Warfare School, the northern training area on Okinawa, Japan. We slept out there, lived out there. The rain never stopped. Everything was muddy and wet, and doesn't take long. Sooner or later, you're going to get cold. You get cold, the fatigue sets in, and everything gets a lot harder. Moving your hands, moving your feet, you're constantly tired. Fatigue like you wouldn't know. He talks about this cold as something that he didn't expect in Vietnam, and that, too, is something that I can relate to, deploying to the Middle East and very surprised to find myself having trouble sleeping in the cold when winter arrived. Difficult conditions, to say the least. He talks about how while they were in Vietnam, even at Christmas time, that they were within range of the North Vietnamese artillery, which is something else that I can relate to. And I want you to just think a second about how this one simple act is crazy enough as it is, that they're going to go and occupy a position that they know is within range of the enemy's artillery. Pretty brazen, right? Well, good old George Pace, the main actor of this story, took matters into his own hands and took the time to build a very special hardened bunker. On Christmas Eve, he gave out invitations for a Christmas party. He was going to have a Christmas party there in Vietnam. Real break from the chaos, if you will. So a great little party started to commence in this little bunker that George Pace had built. Officers enlisted, drinking beer, having a great time. He talks about how the ranks began to get very blended, something else that I can relate to. All of a sudden, the good time, the festivities were stopped short. All of a sudden, unexpectedly, they were taking mortar fire, heavy mortar fire. George Pace packed as many unprotected reporters and unprotected Marines into the hardened shelter as he could until it was full, and there wasn't even enough room for him, so he laid outside completely unprotected. That's how unselfless the man was. He throws a party, things go bad, he sees people in harm's way, makes sure that everyone else is safe before himself. To me, it speaks volumes of the mindset of these men. Truly something to see and experience. The colonel who shared this story, listen to this. He said that 40 years later, that on the day that his brother George Pace died, the 4th of July, he thinks of George Pace every year, 40 years later. I'll tell you why I can relate to this. I wasn't super close to this guy, but we had a guy in our unit. I knew him well enough, Yoverton. His name was Yoverton, a very popular guy. I'm not going to go into the whole story, but when I was reading the story of George Pace, it made me think of Yoverton that we had in our unit. Sadly, Yoverton died a few years after we got out. He was in a tragic motorcycle accident. And I remember the impact that it had on the unit. And I think that there's many guys who were closer to Yoverton. They think about it every year as well. He was a tough guy to lose. But it brings us back to the question, what was it like in Vietnam? Muddy, wet, all taking its toll, cold, no sleep, no fatigue setting in. every joint in your body aching. It might be dehydrated even in those conditions. But there's other problems that develop when you're trying to work and live 24 hours a day in those types of conditions, illnesses, malaria, all kinds of sickness, even just a basic stomach bug. What do you think happens when you've got a stomach virus and you're in combat? You think, oh, hold on, I'm going to take a break. Hold on, we're going to need another roll of toilet paper. None of that is options. You suck it up. I don't even remember any conversations about this kind of thing. Nobody would even bring it up. If you had that kind of a problem in combat, you just suffered. That was the way it worked. Snakes and bugs are another problem. John Podlasky, maybe he'll share his story getting bit by a snake while he was in Vietnam. And I'm hoping maybe he and I can talk a little bit about how dark it was, something very different than what I experienced. When we come back, I'm going to let you hear firsthand from somebody who was there exactly what it was like. John's written about it. He lived it. And I think that he'll be the best one to tell us more about it. Tyler, we can go to break a minute early. We'll give us a little more time with John Podlasky if you're ready. We'll take a little break, and when I come back, we'll bring John on, and we'll talk to him about his experience in Vietnam. I want to talk to him a little bit about why he wrote the book, which is certainly part of it, but we'll talk more about him, exactly what he experienced in Vietnam as well. We'll be right back with John Podlasky, Army Vietnam veteran, author of Cherries, a great guy. We'll be with us in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'll be back. It's not every day that you need a surveyor or civil engineer, but if you're in business, own property, or developing real estate, you know how critical it is to your project to make sure that you get the best. Everything has to be done correctly. It's important that those details are exact to ensure the success of the project. Well, my good friend Michael Tacanelli from STA Engineering is the best there is. It was my first job when I got home from the Marine Corps, working on a survey crew, while Michael back then was the party chief. We hit it off well because of his relentless, disciplined approach. It was something that I agreed with. And I learned a little bit about surveying, an ancient craft that's now done with modern tools, but it still requires a high level of skill and professional expertise. Michael and his team bring all three, skill, expertise, and of course, all the latest tools and technology. The entire package of surveying and engineering, allowing them to provide builders and developers, businesses, and property owners with reliable survey, design, and engineering for land development projects in southeastern Pennsylvania. For your next project, you're going to want to make sure you have the best possible support. Do yourself a favor and hire Michael Tacanelli, STA Engineering. They're already serving some of the area's largest developers, and they've done work in just about every municipality in the county. STA Engineering. Ask for Michael Tacanelli. If you're looking for a veterans organization that you can support, I hope that you'll consider supporting Veterans in Need at Top of Illinois Veterans Stand Down, led by my brother Ron, a dedicated veteran. They host an annual event providing essentials to veterans, from meals, clothing, to VA benefits help, and even haircuts. Every bit of assistance is significant, especially from fellow veterans. The organization thrives on donations sent to P.O. Box 477, Cherryvale, Illinois, 610-16. Ron's commitment is unwavering, but he can't do it alone. If you're in a position to give, your contribution can make a real impact. Stand with us at Top of Illinois Veterans Stand Down, because our veterans deserve your support. I saw Ron not too long ago out in Albuquerque. I was so proud to hear what he's doing, and he's a great guy to do it. If helping a veterans organization is on your list, please consider helping my brother Ron. Top of Illinois Veterans Stand Down, P.O. Box 477, Cherryvale, Illinois, 610-16. There's a magazine that I subscribe to, At Ease Magazine. Great little publication for veterans, very positive, very informative, very well-rounded, lots of broad information there, At Ease Magazine. Well, I'm proud to announce that they did get back to me and say that we're going to be listed on their podcast list for the next quarterly magazine. So hopefully you can find us on At Ease Magazine in the publication there. Very happy to be participating in that. We're going to be bringing on our guest today, John Podlasky, author of Cherries. He's a Vietnam veteran. He's a guy that brings a great voice. I tell you, it was a real honor to interview you, John. And It's a real honor to have you here today. Very motivating to see what you do for veterans. I think it was an incredible conversation that we had, and I thank you. For everyone listening, you can enjoy the full interview that I had with John, now available at projectchaos.org. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast while you're there. We're now doing episode 12 of the radio show. There's more than 25 podcast episodes, including the full interview with John Podlosky. You don't want to miss it. Many other great interviews you don't want to miss there. More to come. It's an incredible pipeline that we have full. Some incredible men, incredible fighters coming on. Women, too, I'm sure at some point, although not in the pipeline right now, but we'll get that, too. But I want to talk to John today. John, it's great to have you here today. Welcome aboard. John, why did you write about Vietnam? What started you initially writing about it?
Well, hey, Chris, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show. In response to your question, this is something that happened maybe 4 or 5 years after I had been married. We were over by my mother's house one Sunday afternoon for dinner, and my mother brought out a shoebox of letters that I had written home from Vietnam. And I'd maintained a diary just listing a sentence or two, you know, for each day's highlighting activities. But as we were going through these letters, my wife kept asking, well, what's this mean? What's that mean? How about explaining this to me? Well, why don't you just take the letters and sort of answer questions as they come up, and we'll go from there. Well, it turned out to become a book at that point.
It's an incredible story, John. And it's a reminder myself, you know, after you told me that, after we did the interview for the podcast, I had all the notes from that, and I had all the notes from the other interviews that I've done here with part of Project Chaos. And after we had that discussion, I went and made a separate file, a special file for them. I said, you know, I better save all these notes from all these interviews. I have a funny feeling it may become a book of its own someday. But very interesting how you pieced all that together. And I don't think it's the first time that letters home have played a role in documenting history. Hey, John, one of the stories I love that you told, if you could tell it briefly, can you tell a little bit about the audio? I haven't gotten a chance to order it yet. We're going to talk about it. We'll do a follow-up show on that as soon as I get a chance. I'm so interested. But tell us a little bit about making the audio and what the narrator was able to do for you. It's very unique.
Well, that was something, too, that the year after I had the book published, we thought we would get into an audio book. And to go through the companies, Amazon or whatever, it was a great cost at that time. So we put out an announcement on social media that we were looking for a narrator. And we had them read a page back to us before we decided upon one particular guy who had just retired from spending 30 years impersonating Frank Sinatra. And he had never done an audio book before. I'd never done an audio book. So this was something that we decided to undertake on our own. He would record. He would send me the record. I would then do all the electronic tweaking on Audible to get it acceptable, and then link each chapter and so on. It was a learning process because I'd never done anything like this before. But he was one that, as we were listening to these samples, my wife picked him out right away. Oh, I like this guy. I like how he sounds. And as we got into the book, which has 13 characters pretty much, he was able to personalize a voice with each one of them. Where if you were to listen to the audio book, there might be some redundancy because it's word for word from the book. But you know, John said, or Bill did this, or it was to the point where he was so good at these voice impersonations that you already knew who it was instead of hearing, well, Bill said while he was doing that. So
it's an incredible story. Yeah, that was the part that I wanted to emphasize. And let me tell you why. There's two parts to that, I think. The first is that here you are, you're an Army veteran, you come home years later, you're writing this book that kind of the same way my book, it wasn't like you planned it out, it was due to some encouragement from others, which is great, but you're trying to figure it out as you go. And writing the book was one thing, and there's a lot of resources available, and it's writing, it's not a new craft really, but you get to the audio book, and I've now narrated and published four of my own audio books, and we're about to have number five. And I know exactly how difficult it is, and it's what I do. And I found it amazing that you were able to overcome those obstacles. And that's why I wanted to tell that story. I found many veterans that whether they want to write a book, they want to figure out how to get published. And I'll just say it right now. If that's you and you're listening, you need any help, reach out to me. I'd be happy to help you, including on the Audible end. But this story gets another level better. Not only were you able to figure it out, you could have hired somebody to do it, and it would have been very expensive to do that. And so instead, you had to figure out your own way of doing it. You figure that out. You got to go through all the sound engineering, which I don't even know how to do, by the way. Four books, I've sent mine out. I contract somebody to do that engineering because Audible wants it to fit a very special way. Then you get to part B of this story, improvise, adapt, and overcome, and you deliver something magnificent. I've been critical of the way Audible, you said it very diplomatically, they will only allow you to read the manuscript in a very rigid fashion. And the way that the manuscript is written isn't always ideal for audio. Sometimes you'd want to make a little adjustment. They will not let you do it. And I think it destroys the quality of the audio. You guys come in and come up with a way to improvise, adapt, and overcome and make it even better. And I thought it was a fantastic inspiration, John, for other veterans. And by the way, all this technological engineering you were wandering through, you were no young guy. How old were you when you were doing that?
Oh, 35.
Okay, so you were younger, but still, that era, that age, certainly not something that you grew up doing. So it's an incredible story of perseverance and making it happen. I want to go to Vietnam a little bit, John, if you could. We spent most of our time on the podcast, most of it, not all of it. We did talk a little bit about Vietnam, and I appreciated everything that you said, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about that because what I was trying to capture today, and I'll tell you why, John. It was something that we said, we had a little conversation after we were done recording, and you very kindly made a comment to me saying that, you know, what I experienced in my deployment was, you know, very consistent, very similar with what you experienced. The suffering, if you will, was in the same category. And I said to you then, I said, I don't think I agree with that at all. And as I thought about it a little bit more, I realized I don't agree with it one bit. You guys had it a lot worse than we did. And I know for a fact, but let's go through it a little bit together. And I think it'll make it a great story. Why don't we start with, and I don't want to be too redundant from the podcast. You talked about your arrival and so forth, but what was your job when you got there?
I was an infantryman.
And you got there, and you weren't assigned to a unit. We talked about this. We had a great conversation. Crazy. You just were sent in like this pool of soldiers initially. You got assigned your unit after the fact. Tell us how you got to Vietnam. Did you fly there? Did you sail there? And when you did get there, when you stepped off the boat or the plane, what was your first impression? What did all that feel like?
Well, it all started in California. And there were thousands of soldiers in a warehouse waiting for their name to be called on the manifest to fly over. I went along with 230 other soldiers on a Pan-American jet. And needless to say, everybody was antsy about landing in a war zone, especially in a commercial airline. But we got there, and there were people on Tansanut Air Base, which was in one of the largest areas in Vietnam. Ben Hoa was the name of the place. They had a reception center there, and there were no weapons anywhere. The only ones that had weapons were the MPs. But hundreds of people, just soldiers, just walking around. They had Vietnamese civilians working on base, doing different things. But we were then assigned to different units throughout the country. I went to the 25th, which was in a base camp called Kuchi, northwest of Saigon. And from that point on, we went through a week's worth of training and then dispatched to a unit out in the field. So there was already 40-some guys in the platoon, 8 to 10 guys in a squad, and you joined and filled a hole from someone that had gone home or died or somebody, but there was a vacancy that needed to be filled. In turn, as you go on, maybe a month later, somebody else was going home. I know when we talked, you were saying that everybody trained as a group and then they went over as a group and came home as a group. We went over as individuals and came home as individuals.
I thought it was an incredible point you made, John, and I've talked about it a few times since then. Thanks for bringing it up. There's a huge distinction right there, and it's a very important part of this story. I don't think it was true for everybody that went to Vietnam, because next week we're going to be interviewing another Vietnam veteran who was part of a Marine brigade, the same as myself, and he went over there as part of his unit. But you guys did not. And I put that all together, and anybody who's heard me talk a little bit about my experience and my story, you can imagine what a difference this would make, that you're going to just fly in there essentially more or less with a bunch of strangers. Would that be an accurate way to say that, John?
Exactly.
You have no idea. You got to build rapport, trust, and all that in a combat zone. Just one quick thing. When you stepped off that plane, where you guys landed on the tarmac, presumably, you got climbed down the stairs. What were you thinking, feeling, smelling? What was it like? You remember?
Well, the one thing that hit everybody when you walked off the air conditioning plane, you walked as soon as you hit the first step on the stairwell there, the heat, the humidity, it was in the upper 90s with upper 90 humidity. You were on air base, so there was a smell of fuel. And the villagers and such, you know, their irrigation systems weren't that good, and they took care of business wherever, you know, on the main street. They would stop at the curb, squat down, take care of business, and then move on. Well, all that smell was predominantly in the air, you know, that's all you did smell. So that was a weird introduction coming into country, and every soldier will remember that first step out of the plane.
It's a great point you make on so many levels. Thank you for that, John. I was expecting you to say about the humidity smacking you in the face, because I know that feeling well a few times, and a lot of others have described that, but you went on to describe the defecation. You did a great job of doing that eloquently, but I want to say this. We don't need to get into it today here, but it's part of the reason why I say we need to be careful that, you know, societies do fall, and we look at what's going around in the world today, and it's so important that we understand these lessons of the past. One of the first things that'll fail when society is beginning to fail is the water and sewer systems. And you have no idea the problem that creates. You get a little glimpse of it right now. You just flew into it. You get off the plane. You go through processing, we'll call it, there at the gang village. And then they ship you out northwest of Saigon, where you join up with about 40 guys who were strangers. What was your initial impression of those guys? What were they like?
Oh, these guys had already lived it, and they had that 1,000-mile stare in their eyes. You were the new guy. You were the cherry. And until you gain their trust, you weren't going to be trusted. And they had to know that you had their six or you had their back, that in the event a firefight started or during night guard duty, that you wouldn't fall asleep, and that you could be depended on to react when the time came. And that took some time. But these guys, you know, here they are, ripped fatigues, unshaven, no haircuts. We used our toothbrushes to clean our weapons and not our teeth. So, you know, looking at a bunch of haggard guys that the ones that were there for a while, they knew each other. They sat together. They cajoled. And here you were an outsider. So you had to work your way into the system, so to speak.
It's a great story, too, John. And I think it points to the what we would call the cynicism that veterans have. It's a very natural, very important cynicism. What's that? No, there are no veteran trusts anybody. You don't give away trust. You don't grant trust. Trust is earned. It's the only way. And the only gets earned or in difficult times that you know that you can absolutely depend on somebody. Easy to depend on somebody when everybody's fat and happy. But when you're tired and hungry and in big trouble, that's when you really learn who you can trust. I want to comment, too, on this weapons cleaning with your toothbrush. It's fascinating to me hearing you say that. Because I speak eloquently about how we would come out of our nighttime fire missions and the morning would start to come around and we would need some sleep. That would be the first thing. But before we would dare close an eye or even take a bite to eat, we would clean our weapons and shave. We had exposure to nerve agent and gas attacks. And you wouldn't dare close an eye until you knew that that weapon was going to be ready when you woke up and that your face was going to be ready, that gas mask could seat properly. And you know what's funny, John, you saying that? I'm sure I did brush my teeth while I was deployed. I promise you I did. But I really don't remember one story about brushing my teeth. But I remember doggone well about cleaning that weapon because it was so important to get it done. So you get there and you got to marry up with these guys. Were they nice? Were they kind?
Nobody wanted to be your friend. At that point, because if so, there was a bond that was created. And if you got wounded and dusted off or you died, you didn't want to go through that misery that another one of your friends bit the dust. And that was the hardest part of that camaraderie is when someone did get wounded or died.
Yeah, I can imagine it was, my brother. You guys get out there, you marry up with this unit, and you guys are go out you're doing your patrols. What, can you describe just a little bit about what kind of patrols you guys engaged in? What were the movements you took place in? What was your work like?
Well, we operated primarily in a flat area. Everything was either rice paddy, rubber plantations where there was tens of thousands of trees that were spaced evenly apart that which no matter which way you look, there was a straight line of trees, but there was very little brush that was growing up wild, but that was a place for engagements. And odd as it seems that even with some of this opening, you would have some of these spiders that were as big as your hand create webs between these tree trunks, which were spaced about 20 feet apart, and they'd be roughly 4 feet off the ground and up. So you would walk right into one, or you'd see it and want to walk around the tree and deviate from your way that you were heading. But the other part was in the jungles, and in the jungles with triple canopy that these trees would reach up 100 feet, it could be in the middle of the day, but yet down on the ground, it seems like 7 o'clock at night, like dusk. So when nighttime came, you could barely see a foot, maybe 2 feet in front of you. And to sit in a night watch and watch your area for movement, it was all basic by sound. You didn't see anything. There was no lights, no flashlights, no electricity, none of that out there. So you sat in the pitch black and just listened. And then when you had that opportunity, imagination kicked off, and then you could start hearing things that weren't there. It was like, even in the night ambushes, it was like walking through a spook house at a carnival. You knew something was going to jump out and grab you, and you were super vigilant, but and the adrenaline was rushing, and then when nothing happened, you still had that adrenaline high. You sat there shaking, trying to get back to normal again. But it was an experience that if somebody did jump out at you, you know, it was over for you.
So you guys, I'd like to just understand a little bit about the movements. Did you guys have a base camp or something like that you operated out of?
We had the base camp, but then each unit had a fire base. And the fire bases were the artillery units and the mortar units were. And after 5-6 weeks out in the jungle, we would be allowed to come back into the fire base for 3 nights. And it was something that you could sleep the whole night through, because out in the field, you normally, the best you got was maybe 2 hours of nonstop sleep. Then it was your turn for guard duty, and you go back to sleep for another 2 hours, then get up and walk, you know, for the next 14 hours looking for the enemy soldiers wherever in their base camps.
John, how old were you when you arrived in Vietnam?
I just turned 19.
So 19 years old. I want to just describe this again, what you just described, because I've lived a little bit of it myself in a little bit different environment. You get into country, you go through this processing center, they push you out to this battle-hardened infantry unit that's taken losses. The NCOs that are there running things, they're not looking to make friends. They're not looking to make nice. They're just looking to survive, looking to get everybody home as best they can. You march out to this base camp out somewhere northwest of Saigon. Beyond that, there's fire bases set up. Now you're pushing out pretty deep into the enemy territory. From there, it's your job, basically, to engage in the enemy. Is that correct? Is that your role, to go out and engage them, right?
We were set out to look for the enemy, engage them and eliminate them.
So let me put this another way. You were out there hunting for people, basically, really, when you think about it. It's a hard job. You're going to say to a young 19-year-old man, go get your rifle, and you go out into that deep, dark jungle through those rice paddies, and you go find those Vietnamese and you shoot them. That was the job. While you're doing it, you're out there for 5 to 6 week patrol rounds with no sleep. And I know exactly, you're going to say 2 hours a night. You're lucky if you're getting 40 minutes there. I know exactly what it's like. And after about 3 or 4 days, a level of fatigue sets in. And I think after about a week, it starts to feel like something very different. And then when those incoming or the outgoing, whatever the case might be, whether the artillery behind you is firing on enemy positions in front of you, or the positions in front of you are trying to fire back at the fire bases behind you or in between, it's like playing 3 video games at the same time. Your eyes never get a break, the adrenaline rush that you get. And you can't even close your eyes if you wanted to. By the time you go through all that, and how long did you stay like that, John? How long were you actually out in the field?
I said, 4 to 6 weeks on an average.
No, I mean, how long was your entire time in Vietnam?
Oh, 12 months.
4 months.
Marines served 13.
So 4 months out there. And how much of that do you think was out in those 4 to 6 week pumps? Most of it, I guess, from the sounds of it.
I lost your question. Clarify that a little bit.
How much of that 4 months in Vietnam was actually spent out in the field? Oh, you spent 12 months, you said. Thank you.
Well, yeah, 12 months.
Well,
that
makes more
sense.
Yeah. So out of the 12 months, I was confused, not you. Out of the 12 months, John, how much do you figure, how many of those months do you think you spent out in the field as a total, as opposed to in base camp or back in the rear somewhere?
Well, the 365 days, I'd say 3 1/4.
Wow. So 325 days out there in rice paddies, jungle, spiders as big as your hand. You got bit by a snake. But before we get to that, what was it like to try and sleep? What was nighttime like, John?
Well, when you moved into a position, you didn't know what was on the floor. A lot of the jungle have these gnarly roots that would be poking out. You just had a poncho that you laid down on the ground and you laid on top of it and covered up. The thing was that you're in a jungle, there's creatures in the jungle, and they're sharing the ground with you. I use an example on my website, how you're laying there and all of a sudden you feel something walking across you as you're laying. I mean, you don't know what it is. Some of these things have long nails or claws that if you try to swat off what it might be, they might dig in and bite you. We had scorpions there. We had rats. There was said to have tigers running loose, and some soldiers disappeared from their night defensive positions. And it was said that tigers came in and picked them up and carted them away. I've never seen a tiger as I was there, but those are some of the tales that you hear.
You know, can you imagine you're the commanding officer of that unit making this report to the battalion commander? We think a guy got carted off by a tiger, but it really speaks to the level. Now, I just described this. Obviously, I wasn't there. I wasn't old enough to be there. And I put this together from the different stories that I've heard. But for these infantry patrols in Vietnam, and it does remind me of jungle warfare school and what they tried to mimic there, sleeping on the ground and everything you describe. I remember jungle warfare school, John, one of my fellow Marines, we got some hot chow out there. And you know how this is just kind of a soupy gravy, but it was hot and that was good. So that was enough. And we ate it up. Well, anyway, the other thing that came with it was some actual bread, right? Not crackers, but actual bread. We'd sop up that gravy with that bread. Well, one of my fellow Marines decided it'd be funny to drop a few pieces of crust around my hooch. And we go in there that night to lay down, and a rat was on my chest that night. I woke up with a little chem light. I could see the rat. I batted this thing off my chest. I could never sleep right on the ground since then. Have you ever slept on the ground since you've been in Vietnam?
Actually, the night I got home, I felt uncomfortable in my bed. It was too soft, and I got off the bed and I slept on the ground. Actually, slept on the floor for about the next 4 or 5 days after I got home.
Holy smokes, man! Oh man! Well, you spent a little more time sleeping on the ground than me, John. I could see how it'd be an adjustment. Crazy stuff. I want to ask you about a little. Thanks for sharing all that. It's really phenomenal. A great story, John. And like I said, I appreciate everything you're doing to bring these stories out for other Vietnam veterans. And I want to talk a little bit about that when we're done, if we have a minute. But I want to get the rest of your story here a little bit before we run out of time. I wanted, if you could, talk a little bit about what it was like coming home. What did you come home to, I guess, when your plane landed back the other direction? And what was the attitude of the country? How did you feel as a veteran? How'd that impact you?
When I came home, it was August of 71. And the war was within 2 years of ending. But going back to 68, I guess that's pretty much when the public turned against the soldiers because of the war, instead of taking up with politicians. So we had come back. We landed in Tacoma, Washington, the middle of the night. It must have been 2 o'clock in the morning or so, and that was on a Pan American jet again. You're out in the middle of the tarmac. We had to walk about a quarter of a mile to the first big building, warehouse building that was there. We had left with our fatigues, so whatever we had worn out in the jungle, if you were ripped up, muddy, it doesn't matter. Whatever you wore climbing onto that plane is what you were wearing going into this place. So the first thing they allowed us to do was take showers. They measured us. We got our dress uniforms with all our medals and whatever. They sat us down to a steak dinner. There were signs all over, thank you for your service, we're proud of you. But then as soon as you were leaving, there was protesters outside of the base fence line. And as the bus came by to take us to Tacoma airport so that we could all fly home. They were throwing tomatoes and eggs and all of those things at us. And once you got to the airport terminal, it's a lot different now with TSA, and they don't allow you past a certain point. Well, back then, you can walk right up to the gate, you know, and wait for people. So after you got your tickets to go home, you had to pass through these groups of people that were protesting. Some spit. You didn't want to. Well, most of us, when we came home, we were kind of spaced out, for lack of a different word. You know, we had been over there, and now we were home. It's a whole new life. And many of us were in a daze anyway. So when we got spit at or whatever have you, it just blew right over. We didn't want to get in trouble. We wanted to get home, you know, and it was normally these soldiers that were walking one or two together instead of a group of eight or 10, then nobody's going to do anything. There'd be a free for all. But, came home, I got a lot of jeering, baby killer, because of some of the things that the press leaked out that had happened over in Vietnam. And we actually got blamed, you know, for going over there and doing the fighting when it wasn't our fault. We were just following orders. But once I got on the plane and started heading home, the stewardesses and everybody on the plane treated us respectfully. We had a stopover in Chicago, and most of the vets got off in Chicago, and there were six of us that were going to continue on to Detroit and get off, and got through the gate. My parents were there. I got my sister and brother got a nice welcome home with a banner, got to introduce them to the other six guys on the plane. None of us knew one another getting on a plane, but man, we were fast friends by the time, 8 hours later, by the time you reached Detroit. And some of the friends that I had in high school, they didn't want anything to do with me. I lost friendships. Others that the true friendships, you know, they stood by me and they still stand by me today. But coming home, we Vietnam veterans had a stigma at that point that these guys were nuts. They have mental issues. They're drug addicts. Hell, they kill babies, and nobody would hire us. You know, so it got to the point where we hid the fact that we were Vietnam veterans. We would not put our service down on applications because these people would just not hire you because you would be too much of a risk. Well, that went away like in 82 when the Vietnam Memorial came out. And I think that was a turning point for the Vietnam vets where we were more recognized. Matter of fact, when I wrote my book and tried to get it out, I had over 100 rejections from different publication houses on the book. And then I learned that 10 years later, well, you could publish it yourself, you know, and what you have to go through. But that stigma lasted, you know, for 16 years after the war ended. And now it's they've got a National Vietnam Veterans Day that was just celebrated on the 29th of March. So it's pretty much forgotten at this point that, hey, let's not blame the warriors. You know, let's blame the politicians because they're the ones that have started the war.
Well, the way I see it, John, I think we're going to handle this a little differently. I say you and I joint efforts, and we write a book about the lying commies that are still with us today. You're still alive today. They're still alive today. And I'd be thrilled to know their names and what they're doing and what they ever did to serve anything. It drives me crazy. It's such a black eye on this country. And all the volumes that are written about the Vietnam and the sacrifice of the Vietnam veterans, maybe we ought to take a look at how poorly this country treated our very own veterans. Everything that you did to come back to that. It's a whole encyclopedia set of its own. It should be sitting right at the front of the Library of Congress for every American to read. Don't do this ever again. I'll talk more about that in a second, John. Let me finish with this before we let you go. I appreciate your time, brother. So much you've done for veterans, the community, and to come on here today and speak of this. It's huge. It takes a lot. I know it does. But one last question for you, brother. Is there any ways that you found that your service benefited you?
Oh, by all means. When I got back from Vietnam, I still had 6 months to serve before my 2-year obligation was over. And because the war was winding down, I ended up getting a 2-month early out. So from February, they backed me up to just before Christmas, I got out. And the car manufacturer, supplier manufacturer that I worked for at that time, they had laws that if you had to go into service, then they were mandated to keep that position open for you. And this was an hourly position. But when I went, I was promoted to a sergeant before I got out. I had letters of recommendation. And when I got back to the company where I worked, I showed them the letters of recommendation. Sure, they were going to put me back in my former position. But because of being a sergeant, having leadership roles, these letters of recommendations, they, instead of putting me back to the hourly position, they put me in a salary position and made me a supervisor. So here I am back from the war and out of the service, and right away I'm a supervisor. And I was in management for the rest of my career, you know, spending almost 50 years in management. And being in the service and going through what I had to go through helped me, or primed me, so to speak, for that position and made me successful through my career.
John, thanks so much for that, my brother. I got to run, but it's really a great word for veterans struggling out there. Veterans come back, you're a little confused, the world's a different place than you thought it was, and you still work to make the best of it. I already know the answer to this question, John. I'd like to hear you tell the audience. If you had to do it all over again, would you do it?
In a minute.
I know you would. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate you coming today. I appreciate you coming. Hey, one last thing before I let you go, John. Where can people find you?
I have my website called Cherries Writer, WRITER.com. There's links. There's 650 different articles and posts. There's pictures. There's music. There's something for everybody. I've read and reviewed over 100 Vietnam books, and my book reviews are posted there on the website. So, and there's links to the 6 books that I had written.
CherriesWriter.com. Go check out John's work at CherriesWriter.com. It's fantastic. I've been following John on LinkedIn, and I'll tell you what, I learn something new every day. It's really amazing what he posts, and I can't tell you what this does for the veteran community. Before we close out today, and thanks so much for that rich history there, John, that perspective of a veteran. It was very different what these guys experienced. As I'm listening, I say, what the hell happened between Iwo Jima and 1965 that allowed this to happen? And then here's what I want to tell you, one of the reasons why I'm so grateful for these Vietnam guys. Number one, they're hard as heck to talk to, generally speaking. And it can be very difficult because of what these guys went through, the whole sham that they experienced. You hear it coming back. How could you want to talk about that? How could you be excited to talk about that? It took years to work through. Still, for some of these guys, they don't want to talk about that. But I want to tell you the story of two different paths. When the whole world was going to hell in a handbasket, you know, highly educated idiots in this country, all over our veterans, spitting in their faces, acting like vile animals that they are. We should have their names right now. Forget about the wall memorial. I want to know the names of the people that were throwing the tomatoes and spitting on the veterans. That's the names that we should have in front of us. But I want to tell you the story of two different paths. There was a group of people that were spitting and throwing and carrying on, but there was another group that said, we're not going to let this stand, that we're not going to let this continue. And many of those were Marines in my own unit that said, you know what, we're not going to let this happen again. So what did they do? They stayed in, they persevered, and they rebuilt the Marine Corps. I can't speak to the Army, but I know the same thing was going on because we were there beside them as well, and they had the same resurgence. And what we experienced during my time in was nothing like what you just described. Nothing. It was completely different in an incredibly great way. And for it, we were able to provide incredibly great security to our country. And it's being destroyed, as well as the legacy of our veterans. It's not right. It's not good. And that's why Project Chaos is here. Be sure to check it out at projectchaos.org. Thanks, Tyler, for the great work today. We'll see you back next week. So hope to see you here 4 o'clock Mondays. Projectchaos.org.